Behits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Jill Robbins, Anna Mateo, and Katie Weaver. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
The United States and its major allies have accused China of working with criminal hackers to carry out major computer attacks worldwide. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said in a statement Monday that China had shown irresponsible, disruptive, and destabilizing behavior in cyberspace. Such activities present a major threat to our economic and national security, he added. Joining the U.S. in condemning China's actions were NATO, the European Union, Britain, Japan, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. The group blamed China for a cyber attack in March that affected tens of thousands of organizations using Microsoft Exchange servers. Blinken said the U.S. had uncovered evidence that the Microsoft attack was carried out by cyber actors linked to China's Ministry of State Security. The U.S. and the other countries said the Ministry of State Security had employed criminal contract hackers to carry out attacks. Officials said the activities included software attacks against private companies known as ransomware. In these kinds of attacks, criminal hackers hijack the computer data of companies until they agree to pay large amounts of money or ransoms. A U.S. government official told reporters that the government had raised its concerns with high-level Chinese officials about the country's malicious cyber activity. The use of contract hackers by China's civilian intelligence agency was especially eye-opening and surprising, the official said. A joint cybersecurity advisory was issued Monday by the National Security Agency, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. It said the agencies had observed increasingly sophisticated Chinese state-sponsored cyber activity. The activity had targeted U.S. political, economic, military, educational, and critical infrastructure, the advisory said. There was no immediate comment from Chinese officials on the new accusations. In the past, Chinese officials have said China is also a victim of hacking and that the country opposes all forms of cyber attacks. The U.S. did not announce any restrictions against China for the activities it was accused of taking part in. However, the U.S. administration official told Reuters that the United States is not ruling out further action to hold China accountable. Also on Monday, the Justice Department announced charges against 4 Chinese nationals. They are accused of working with the Ministry of State Security in a worldwide hacking campaign. U.S. officials said the activities took place between 2011 and 2018. They targeted numerous computer systems, including those of companies, universities, and governments. The operations attempted to steal trade secrets and other business information that could help Chinese companies, the officials said. I'm Brian Lin.
Pope Francis placed limits Friday on the use of Latin in the Roman Catholic Church service called Mass. The decision cancels a reform established by Pope Benedict XVI, who led the church just before Francis. Benedict had ordered that Latin could be used in special celebrations of the Mass. He also permitted the use of Latin in usual Masses if the membership of an individual church requested it. Pope Francis said he made the change because Benedict's reform had caused division in the church. He also said the measure had been abused by Catholics seeking the cancellation of major changes made by the church in 1960. Known as Vatican II, the changes were designed to reshape the church for modern times. Catholics reacted quickly to Pope Francis's announcement Friday. Some objected to his decision and said it felt like an attack on them and ancient customs. Others seemed shocked by the action. They said they had never known a pope to so directly reject an important ruling of the preceding pope. The 84-year-old Francis did not ban Latin Masses. But now, churches that want to celebrate Latin Mass will have to receive permission to celebrate it from higher officials and approval from the Vatican. Also, church officials will investigate individual churches currently celebrating Latin Mass to learn if they accept Vatican II. Those groups will not be permitted to use usual Catholic churches. Instead, higher officials must find other places for them without creating new parishes. In addition, Francis said, the church will not permit the formation of new Latin Mass services. Francis said he was taking action to support unity and heal divisions within the church that had grown since Benedict's 2007 reform. He said he based his decision on findings of a 2020 Vatican study of all middle-level Catholic officials, known as bishops. Francis said the research uncovered a worrisome and saddening situation that made him see the need to intervene. One of the reasons Francis gave in his letter was based on a document from Vatican II. The bishops of that time said using modern languages meant celebrants would not assist as strangers and silent spectators in the mystery of faith, but with a full understanding of the rites and prayers. The Pope's action immediately angered traditionalists already opposed to his policymaking, which is more liberal than was Benedict's. Joseph Shaw is chairman of the Latin Mass Society of England and Wales. This is an extremely disappointing document, which entirely undoes the legal provisions set up by Benedict, he said. Others supported Francis's move. Christopher Belito
is a professor of church history at Kane University in the American state of New Jersey. He said Francis was right to intervene, noting that Benedict's reform had had many unwanted results. Among them, he said, were new divisions within the church and, for a time, poorer relations with Jews. I'm Jill Robbins.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. In the United States, the law views domestic animals, or pets, as property when married people legally separate. Now, American courts are seeing new ways of deciding custody of the family pet. Special negotiators are being employed to argue for pet parents. Some couples are even signing contracts before they marry about pet ownership if the marriage ends. These so-called pet nups are designed to avoid possible courtroom disputes in the future. Pet nup is a play on the word prenup. Prenup is short for prenuptial, a contract that some couples seek before marriage. Prenups usually deal with property rights. Several pet owners and lawyers recently talked to the Associated Press.
In some U.S. states, laws permit judges to decide pet custody based on the best interest of the animal under consideration. New York lawmakers are considering such a bill. New York State Senator James Skoufis is the main supporter of the New York measure. He also has a cat named Ruth for the late Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Skoufis spoke to the Associated Press about the proposed legislation. Someone's cat or someone's dog is a part of their family and should not be treated like a piece of furniture, he said.
Adam Citron is a New York divorce lawyer. He says pet custody is always a difficult issue, so he supports prenups that include pets. A pet nup can be especially helpful when people get animals during the marriage. He added that pet custody is far more emotional and difficult to settle than ownership over a set of dishes or a car. In states without these laws, Citron suggests this. Before a couple gets an animal, they should decide whose name will appear alone on registration or ownership papers. That person should pay any costs linked to the pet with their own money. Some negotiators say they work to solve pet disputes through shared custody. Others say that that is not always best for the animal, especially dogs. Dogs are most often at the center of pet custody disputes.
Miles Mason Sr. is a divorce lawyer in Memphis, Tennessee. He told the AP about one couple's especially heated pet custody battle. He said the wife and husband fought about their two German Shepherd dogs. The wife had taken training to better control the large dogs. The husband had not. Before the divorce, the husband lost control of one of their dogs while on a walk. It attacked and killed another dog. The wife argued later that the husband should not get custody of their dogs because he could not control them. When the couple separated, the husband wanted to visit their dogs. A judge agreed, but said the visits must be supervised and take place at the wife's home. However, the judge said he could reconsider the decision if the man sought training on how to control German shepherds. We believe the judge had experience with German shepherds because he understood the concerns with highly trained and disciplined dogs, the lawyer said.
Karis Nafti has studied animal behavior for nearly 26 years. 2 years ago, she started working as a pet custody specialist for people seeking divorces. Part of what I try to help people understand, she said, is that even if a dog feels like a child in your heart, it isn't. In fact, treating your pet like a child could do harm to the animal. Visitation schedules or shared custody, Nafti said, can be far harder on a dog than a permanent separation. A dog moving between two homes on a usual basis, she said, can lead to behavioral problems. She added that expert advice can help. A lot of times, she said, people just don't know what to do. They just don't want to say goodbye to their dog. Nafti suggested putting pet custody at the top of divorce negotiations. It can make the rest of the process run more smoothly.
Mental health workers can help couples too. Marriage expert Sharon O'Neill has helped couples through divorce in New York's Westchester County for more than 20 years. In one case, during a discussion with a couple, a wife demanded that she must keep the dog. However, her husband did not believe she cared enough to take responsibility for the animal.
In working with her alone, I came to understand that it had more to do with hurting her husband because she truly believed he loved the dog more than he had ever been capable of loving her, O'Neill said. The mental health advisor said the couple was able to get to the truth through talking. They agreed that he would get the dog and she would get a set of furniture. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Anna Mateo.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about George Walker Bush. He took office in 2001 as the 43rd president. He has a similar name to another president, his father, George Herbert Walker Bush. To simplify things, Americans sometimes call the younger Bush 43, or simply W. Here we will just call him Bush. Because Bush is a recent president, historians have not reached a broad agreement on his time as a leader. But he will surely be remembered for facing one of the biggest challenges to any president, the attacks against the U.S. on September 11, 2001. George Bush was born in the northeast state of Connecticut, but his parents soon moved to the southwest state of Texas. George grew up there and considered Texas home. The Bush family had a long background in politics. Bush's grandfather was a senator. His father held many public offices. In some ways, George was prepared for a career in politics, too. He went to the same private boarding school as his father. Then, like his father and grandfather, George went to Yale for college. He also worked on several political campaigns. But he said he did not consider pursuing politics. Instead, he earned a degree in business at Harvard and took a job in an oil company in Texas. In time, he founded his own oil business. And he married Laura Welch, who was a teacher and librarian in their hometown. They had twin daughters named Barbara and Jenna. In these years as a young adult, Bush began to make some changes. He began attending a Christian church regularly. He decided to stop drinking alcohol because it was creating problems in his personal life, and he turned his attention to politics. Bush lost the first election in which he competed, a race to become a member of Congress. So, for a while, he focused on business investments and helping his father's political career. But in 1992, his father lost re-election to the presidency, and the younger Bush saw a chance to enter politics himself again. In 1994, Bush ran for governor of Texas. To many people's surprise, he won. 4 years later, he was overwhelmingly re-elected. Many voters liked his image as what he called a compassionate conservative. In other words, he wanted to use traditional Republican ideas about government to help society. Following two successful terms as governor, Bush turned his attention to the presidency. In 2000, he competed against the vice president at the time, Al Gore. The winner was not announced until more than a month following the election. Usually, the winner is announced within hours. Both sides disputed the process of counting votes in the state of Florida. Finally, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on the process. The court ordered state officials to stop recounting votes. Bush's lead stood. Bush entered office expecting to bring many of the ideas he pursued in Texas to the entire nation. For example, as president, he permitted religious groups to receive government funding and set national standards for public schools. These moves were popular with many voters, but they also challenged some American traditions. The separation of church and state and the ability of public schools to govern themselves. For many presidents, these policies might have created a legacy. But early in Bush's term, he faced a crisis that defined much of his time in office. Hijackers linked to the Al-Qaeda group seized four airplanes on September 11, 2001. They purposely crashed two planes into the twin towers of the World Trade Center in New York City, eventually killing more than 2,700 people. Another plane was flown into the Pentagon, the country's military headquarters outside of Washington, D.C. About 200 people died there. The fourth plane was aimed at another important target. But passengers fought the hijackers. The plane lost control and crashed in a field in Pennsylvania. All 44 people on board died there. President Bush was visiting an elementary school in Florida that morning. He learned about the attacks while he was reading with the children. At the end of the day, Bush spoke to the nation. He said the U.S. would answer both the terrorist groups and the countries that permitted terrorist groups to thrive. Over the next years, Bush took a number of actions to create a new national security strategy. They included creating a Department of Homeland Security, making changes to the country's intelligence operations, and reforming the U.S. military. He also sent U.S. forces into Afghanistan to destroy terrorist networks there. Bush was especially targeting the person who had designed the September 11 terrorist attacks, Osama bin Laden. The struggle in Afghanistan was successful at first, but continued throughout Bush's time in office, and bin Laden was not captured while Bush was president. In 2003, Bush opened another front on what some called the War on Terror. He and other government officials said the leader of Iraq, Saddam Hussein, was developing weapons that could kill many people. They said Hussein and his connections to terrorist groups threatened Americans and people in other countries. Hussein did not agree to leave Iraq. So U.S. and British forces launched bombs at targets in the country's capital. Additional troops destroyed what was left of the targets. Hussein was quickly overthrown. But the weapons of mass destruction were not found. For the rest of Bush's presidency, U.S. forces remained in Iraq. Bush promised that Americans would stabilize the country and help Iraqis create a democratic government. The presidency of George W. Bush is too recent to understand its impact. But there is some evidence of the public's reaction at the time. Bush received some of the highest ratings of any president. In the weeks following the September 11 attacks, 90% approved of his leadership. He was re-elected in 2004. But his popularity steadily decreased. At the end of his second term, he had one of the lowest public approval ratings of any president, 33%. The U.S. economy had entered a recession. More Americans disagreed, especially with his decision to invade Iraq. And some criticized his government for responding too slowly after Hurricane Katrina struck New Orleans and the country's Gulf Coast. Since Bush left the White House in 2009, his approval ratings have, like those of many presidents, risen again. He has mostly avoided public appearances. Instead, he has enjoyed playing sports, helping charities, and reading U.S. history. He also began a new hobby, painting. He has created portraits of dozens of veterans to honor their service in the military. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.